I'm willing to bet that you, as a person, probably don't lie awake at night thinking about the balance between inflation and employment. Okay, well, unless you're Janet Yellen, then probably you do.
I'm very focused on trying to achieve our congressionally mandated objectives, and I really haven't had to give further thought at this point to this question.
There she was, the Federal Reserve Chair on Capitol Hill this week, saying she plans to serve out her full term. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And when Janet Yellen says congressionally mandated objectives, what she means is keeping prices stable and creating full employment. That is what Congress says the Federal Reserve should do. And honestly, it's hard to know if we're there, in part because full employment is a confusing phrase. Right now, the unemployment rate is 4.4%. And if you were watching business TV about a week ago, you would have seen a bunch of reporters outside the Labor Department announce the latest job numbers on the air.
That may be one factor pushing up the unemployment rate to 4.4%.
The unemployment rate did tick slightly higher to 4.4%.
So that unemployment rate that we're seeing is starting to reflect a real full employment situation.
It's a pretty good report. And the 4.4% unemployment rate would be really good at pretty much any other time in U.S. history. But the job market is sort of like someone recovering from a nasty breakup. Yes, the recession is in the rearview mirror, but things don't always feel that good. And the tools we have to measure it all, like the unemployment rate, are a little blunt. They miss stuff, like the human cost of wanting a job but not having one, or not quite having the one you want. Martha Ross has been studying this at the Brookings Institution, and we brought her on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I've been one of those people running out. You sprint to the cameras, you say how many jobs were created, you say what the unemployment rate was. What does someone like you look for instead?
Well, I do look at the unemployment rate because it is an important measure, but it's incomplete if you want to get a sense of how people are faring in the labor market. So another measure that I look at is the employment rate, which is the share of people who are working. And what you see there sometimes tells you a different story than the unemployment rate tells you.
You know, you and I use terms like in the labor market. And that can sound really academic. What does that mean if you are in the labor market?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there are a couple different ways to think about people in relation to work. One is the most simple and straightforward. You are working. You have a job for which you get paid. Another category is being unemployed, which means you aren't working. You want to work and you've actively looked in the past 4 weeks. Those two groups together equal the labor force. If you are, quote, not in the labor force, you could be doing a bunch of different things. It's not as clear cut. You could consider yourself retired. You could have disabilities that prevent you from working. Or you could really want a job but have not looked in the past 4 weeks because you don't think you can get one.
And the way the government counts the numbers, if you haven't looked, you don't get counted.
Right.
So I guess one question I have for you is when we think about what we know about the health of the labor market in the United States, are the tools we have that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out every month, are those good tools? Do they give us a decent picture?
They do. I think we over-rely on the unemployment rate. But part of the problem is different people ask different things of these measures. So on the one hand, you could look at the unemployment rate as a measure of economic performance on the assumption that we want, you know, high numbers of people to be working. You could also look at it as a measure of sort of human misery and hardship. Who is doing poorly? But the problem with that is that the consequences of unemployment differ, and you need more information sometimes to know how well or how poorly they're doing. If you are a breadwinner who was laid off and you've been unemployed for 5 months and your unemployment benefits are going to run out soon, you're probably pretty stressed out. If you are someone who is married to someone who is working full-time and you're looking for a part-time job, you're probably not as stressed out.
Do you think we should redefine what it means to have a job in America?
I think we should start thinking more broadly, because in some ways what these measures all count is what are you doing with your time? Are you working? Are you looking for work? And then we have this broad category of are you doing something else? And often it's under – there are a few sort of socially accepted other activities to do, raising kids, going to school, that sort of thing. But that's a pretty narrow way of thinking about how someone can be productive and make a contribution to their families and their communities.
One question that we've asked on this show, and I know Kai Ryssdal has asked on his show, is are we at full employment? It's this phrase that economists like to use, but it sounds like, you know, you have found these gaps where there are people who would like to have more work and they don't have them. Do you think we're at full employment?
I don't know if we are. I mean, we haven't seen wages go up. Yeah. And if we were at full employment, I think there would be less slack in the labor market and there'd be more demand and you'd see wages increase. So here's where I go back to the measure of employment or unemployment, sort of the misery or hardship measure. And the folks who are more persistently disadvantaged with low levels of education, even in a, quote, full employment economy, it's not as likely that they're going to be okay.
What would you do to help those people be okay or get back to a more stable working situation?
Well, that is the hardest question of all. We just have so many people who have very limited work experience, so they aren't going to have the soft skills. And those people disproportionately have pretty low reading and math skills. And those two things are a huge barrier. But if you look at what the U.S. spends on what are called active labor market policies, you know, strategies to help people find a job, compared to other OECD countries, we're really low. We just don't prioritize it. We kind of throw people into the labor market and have them sink or swim. And we don't have the kind of partnerships between schools and community groups and employers that would create more structured pathways. It used to be that with a high school diploma, we could throw you into the labor market as a young person and assume it would work out for the best because you would get a job and you would earn good wages. And now that's not the case.
Martha Ross is a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now let's hear from exactly who Martha Ross was talking about. People who've been out of work for a while or are maybe underemployed. That's how Karen Wilkinson describes herself. She lives in Sacramento, California.
And the last time I had full-time with benefits work was in 2014. That is when I was laid off from a job as a news reporter for a news website here in Sacramento.
Since then, Karen has been doing freelance work, teaching yoga and writing for a magazine. She feels stressed, but not hopeless.
Somehow, I've made it work. And it probably helps that the cost of living here is lower than some other parts of California.
Alyssa Paskin lives in New York City. She lost her full-time job at a law firm several years ago when the owners retired. Now, at 62, she's been doing per diem work ever since. But that doesn't mean she isn't hoping for full-time employment. Except Alyssa isn't sure when that's going to happen.
I honestly don't know, but I can't afford not to hope that things will be at least steadier.
She doesn't know if she has the network and connections to land a full-time job. And the burdens of not having a steady income are starting to add up.
Yeah, unless you're really, you know, financially well set, it's extremely, extremely stressful to be unemployed for anybody, but especially as you age.
But one of the biggest costs isn't financial, it's emotional.
You don't have a steady place to go, you tend to become more isolated. And they say the most unhealthy thing in terms of illness and people growing older is social isolation.
Alyssa tries to make sure she isn't isolated. She takes care of an older friend. And that doesn't change the fact that she needs a job. But for today, she's hopeful. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. And no, we are not letting this show go by without mentioning healthcare. On Thursday, Senate Republicans unveiled another plan to repeal Obamacare. It still needs a score, that's the cost estimate in Washington speak, from the Congressional Budget Office. And that'll say what this bill would do to the deficit and how it would affect Americans' health coverage. So while we wait for that news, some of you have been sending us your healthcare stories. Amanda Coyne from Atlanta shared her experience. Her father died of colon cancer at the age of 35. And at 20, Amanda herself was diagnosed with colon polyps. She was told to keep an eye on them.
Now, 3 years later, I'm almost 24, and I'm having symptoms that would indicate that I need to get checked out again for polyps that could possibly be precancerous. But I just 2 months ago had Bell's palsy, which caused me not only to drain my HSA, but my savings account. And so financially, I can't go to the doctor. I have a $11,000 deductible on my insurance, which I have through my mother, who's a teacher, because I work as a contractor in a great job that I love, but that doesn't give me benefits. So right now I'm stuck hoping these symptoms will go away and hoping that I don't have polyps again and hoping that they're still not precancerous like the last time.
Send us your healthcare stories. We're weekend@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. 1-800-648-5114. Recently, there was a minor kerfuffle about the long-standing dress code for one of the rooms in the U.S. Capitol and about whether sleeveless tops worn there are, quote, work appropriate. That code is getting an update, but honestly, what to wear to work, especially when it's a zillion degrees out, can be really confusing. Every month on this show, Ask a Manager's Allison Green joins us to answer your work-life questions. So we jumped right in with a question from Twitter. Is it ever okay to wear shorts in the office?
So if you have a dress code of any sort in your office, probably not. Even if your office is business casual, you can't really wear shorts in a professional environment. It's interesting because fashion magazines love to show these sort of businessy looking shorts that are made out of suit-like material.
Yeah.
But in real life, I don't know who's wearing them. In real life, it's highly unlikely that someone working in an office can get away with wearing those. Maybe if you worked in the fashion industry, but for the rest of us, it's pants, a dress, or a skirt, but no shorts.
Here is a different story about shorts in the office from Karen Townsend.
We had an intern show up one day wearing leather mini shorts and high heels. Her male boss was uncomfortable having the conversation with her, so I was nominated to discuss it. I called her into my office to tell her she couldn't wear shorts at all, certainly not shorts that short, and definitely not leather shorts either, and that she needed to go home to change, or if she preferred, she could just come back the next day. Instead of being embarrassed or awkward like I'd predicted, she instead argued with me, told me that it was a perfectly professional look, and asked why I even cared. Of course, then we had to talk about attitude.
Okay, Allison, what do you do, especially if you're a manager, when somebody shows up in something that is inappropriate?
Yeah, if someone is way over the line, you have to say something. Really, the easiest way to ward it off is to have a clear dress code that spells out what is and isn't okay up front. I think it would be nice to assume that because we are all adults, you can trust people to use their own judgment and show up looking reasonably professional. But offices find over and over again that it's not the case. So if there are categories of things that you know you don't want people to show up wearing, put it in a clear policy so that everyone is on the same page and you can avoid a lot of awkward conversations. That said, even when you have that clear policy, some people are going to still violate it. If it happens, the best thing to do is be straightforward, be matter of fact. I think people tend to agonize over talking to people about dress because it feels so personal, like you're commenting on their fashion sense. But it's
it can
really
feel
okay
sexist
to,
too.
Yes, it really can, which is another reason why you want to have a pretty clear written policy to point to so that you're not stuck making a judgment call every time. But if someone is clearly over the line, it's okay to just say, you know, hey, those are great shorts, but they're outside our dress code. Can you save it for the weekend?
Okay, I think I know where you're going with this, but I want to play you one more question because this was something we just got so many questions about. All right, let's hear this one about footwear from Karen Yen.
For context, I work in Silicon Valley in my company's IT organization. Are flip-flops okay to wear to work ever? I'm not a fan, but see it on others all the time.
All right, flip-flops.
Flip-flops are probably the most hated clothing item I hear about. People are passionate about their dislike of flip-flops at work. I think it's because the sound that they make when you walk in them. I will say I love flip-flops, but they're at the top of people's list of things that annoy them about workwear. And so I think you've got to consider them a strong no in general. That said, do some people wear them? Yes, at some offices people do. So it really comes down to what your office says about them. So with the collar, for instance, it sounds like they are okay in her organization. Annoying maybe, but it sounds like in that culture they're okay.
There's a class question that came to us that I find really interesting. This is from Alan McDougall, who was tweeting at us, and he said, when are we finally going to drop the whole ridiculous office attire charade that hurts lower paid workers and makes so many uncomfortable? Because this gets at this question of class, payment, inequality, all this stuff. I mean, it can be expensive to dress for work.
It's true. I mean, I will say that you can dress professionally on a pretty low budget if you check out like secondhand stores and consignment stores. Whether or not you should have to do that is a question worth asking, I think. But as a society, we're a long way away from abandoning this idea that people should dress for the occasion. And a lot of businesses have dress codes because their customers respond better to it, or they think their customers will respond better to it. I mean, a lot of people don't want the person who's handling their taxes, for example, to show up in shorts and a t-shirt. And until that changes, I think we are stuck with dress codes.
All right, Allison, so lay it out for us. What would you say are the three rules, if you had to pick them, for dressing in the office?
The absolute biggest one is to know your office. Pay attention to any written policy, pay attention to what colleagues are wearing, and in particular, pay attention to the colleagues who you admire, because they might be wearing different things than, like, the slacker who works down the hall. That's the biggest one. I think, two, if you're frustrated by dress codes, try seeing it as a sort of uniform. Find a few combinations that work for you. If you look great in an A-line skirt and a silk blouse and you're comfortable in that, great. Get it in a few different colors and patterns and just be done with it. Have a go-to set of outfits so that you don't have to agonize in your closet every morning. And then three, I think don't listen to fashion magazines when they tell you what is appropriate workwear. They have a much more exotic idea of what you can wear to work than what real offices will have.
Allison, you are going to be giving us advice every month. I am an avid reader of your column, so I have to bring up a letter that just, I almost don't even know where to start. I'm just going to read the first line of it. So I bit a coworker yesterday. Obviously, I'm mortified. What? Wait, this
yes.
is real? You got a letter from a lady who bit somebody?
I did. And actually, I mean, it's a fascinating letter for all kinds of reasons. But I think the biggest one is she's miserable in her job and she's working in a really unprofessional environment. And it's sort of infected her. She's now stooping to the level of all her terrible coworkers to the point that she actually bit someone. And it's, I mean, there's so much to say about biting a coworker. But I think ultimately it's got to be a flag for her that she has to get out of that environment, that it's turning her into someone who bites colleagues, and that's not someone she wants to be.
We're going to keep Allison around for just one more moment to talk about a growing phenomenon, remote work. According to a Gallup survey, 43% of Americans said they spent at least some time working remotely last year, and that number's up from the last survey in 2012. It's similar to how work is changing in other ways. flexible scheduling, unlimited paid time off. In short, things millennials in particular seem to want. But how does it really work out if you're working from out of the office? One company is taking the idea of remote work to the extreme. It's called WeRoam, and it takes professionals on a 12-month round-the-world trip where they work remotely on their own time. Here's what it's like to do that.
Hi there, my name's Rachel Reif, and I am currently a roamer on WeRoam's first tour, Polaris. I originally reside in Venice Beach, California. I'm 32 years old and a senior project manager at Cali One Services, a residential and commercial solar installation company. Right now, we are recording this in Berlin in the middle of town at a super cool co-working space. The most interesting thing about this journey has been working California hours throughout South America, Africa, and now Europe. It's been about just being fluid and rearranging my days and not getting used to any set schedule. The main thing I have learned is to never not do anything I want to do. So that usually means getting in 4 to 5 good hours on the computer and setting up my work day from my phone and not missing out on dinners and festivities and anything I want to do around the city. After this year, I will have worked in 6 continents and numerous countries on California hours, which I think will be my greatest achievement, along with meeting such amazing people and truly having the most interesting and diverse year of my life.
Okay, Allison, I listen to that and I think, boy, that sounds really cool. And then the other part of me says, wait a minute, how does that work out for her boss? And can you really be productive when you are working all over the world? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it depends on the job. There's some jobs where you really do need to be physically present in the same space as your coworkers. But there's some jobs where you probably could do it from anywhere. I think the key is that the remote person's manager has to really be managing them. You need a boss who is able to judge people by the results that they're getting, who will spot it and address it if the person isn't producing the results that you'd expect to see, who's going to check in regularly enough that everyone stays connected and stays aligned about the work. I think where you see problems develop with remote work, there's usually a manager who isn't doing his or her job. But if you have a good manager, letting people work remotely can be a pretty great way of attracting and retaining good people. I mean, who doesn't want to do that?
There's this Gallup poll that says 43% of Americans say they spent at least some time working remotely in the last year, and that number is up. Do you think remote work is a trend? And is it actually sustainable?
Yeah, I think it's one of the biggest workplace trends that we've seen in the last decade or more. And I think we're going to be seeing it more and more. And it's really helped along by technology. We have the technology today that makes it possible for a huge number of people to do their jobs remotely when, you know, 15 years ago, they couldn't do it. So, and I also think that we're seeing more and more people look for at least some amount of remote work. Maybe it's not 100% of the time, but maybe it's every Friday from home or every other Friday. I think there's more demand for that, and that employers who want to attract the strongest employees are going to have to be accommodating about that interest.
Allison, you'll be with us every month giving advice on life in the office. And if anybody's got questions, you can email weekend@marketplace.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're MarketplaceWKND. And we'll put a link to your advice in our newsletter. Details on how to subscribe to that are at marketplace.org. Allison Green, Ask a Manager, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To learn more about WeRoam, we got Nathan Yates on the line. He's one of the company's founders. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Where are you?
I kind of end up asking myself that when I wake up a lot these days, but I'm in Berlin at the moment.
Okay. And can you explain how this business works?
Yeah. So essentially, we curate groups of professionals who have the ability to work remotely, and we get them in groups and kind of build out these itineraries where they can travel together in these communities around the world, stopping for 1 month at a time at different cities. We take care of all of the logistics, the travel between destinations, cool professional development, projects, different cultural events along the way, and they pay us a monthly fee.
Yeah, I ran through your numbers. It looks like they pay somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000 for a reservation and then $2,000 a month?
That's correct. It does also includes accommodations and access to 24/7 workspace as well.
What kind of businesses do you partner with, and how do you pitch to them, hey, working with us is a good idea?
It's fairly complicated, right? Most people assume, and I think I did too getting into this, that it would be a lot of freelancers. The tech community comes to mind. Part of it was conscious, but part of it too was just where the market's going. We found that we were putting together a pretty diverse group of people. We have everyone from doctors and lawyers and finance people to marketers to programmers to engineers, people in fashion. It's less about the type of work they're doing or the type of role that they're in, and more about the type of company that they work for. And so we are, you mentioned partnering with the companies themselves. So that's actually a big part of our focus. To your question about, you know, what is in it for them, right?
Yeah.
It really comes down to, I think, three things mainly. It's about recruiting, it's about retention, and it's about development.
Well, you know, one thing I'm curious about is, so $2,000 a month is not a small amount of money. Do you think, with a sort of elite group of travelers moving around the world, or is this a business where you could see it being offered at a lower price point? And you know, if companies get more involved, sort of to a broader swath of workers?
We are always looking for ways to be able to provide this and make this reality for a larger group of people, right? And so you're right. And at the moment, $2,000 a month, it almost has to be a situation where that's replacing your rent, right? And
right.
For people in New York and LA and London and Berlin and Sydney, a lot of people are paying more than that for apartments. Being able to give up their apartment and do this and get all the travel and stuff, it makes sense. But there is a struggle kind of outside of that. And if you talk about, we have a lot of interest from people in South America and some other developing countries in Asia, it can be a struggle to make the finances work. And even in the heartland of the U.S. in some cases. So I think the way you bridge that gap is the companies getting more involved and treating this as a benefit and supplementing some of the cost. And we are looking into doing trips that are a little bit more modified. So maybe you stay 3 months in one location, which obviously lowers some transportation costs, and then you can bring down some of those costs, and you can offer it to a more diverse group of people, which is definitely our goal. But that, I think that's a little bit down the road.
You all are not the only company that does something like this. And, you know, there's this Gallup poll that says 43% of Americans spent some time working remotely. How do you see this market, you know, a year out, 5 years out, and what kind of a business move does that mean for you guys?
You're right. There are other companies doing it, but currently it's still such a niche space, right? There's such a small percentage of the people who could be doing this that are doing it. So there's still a lot of market share to be taken up that way. And then if you look at some of these other markets in these other countries, like the EU, like the UK, like Australia, there's almost no market penetration in those places. And they have a lot of young professionals who work for progressive companies and could do something like this. And they have no idea that this isn't even an option. So I think that there's space for us to grow with this core product. But I think more importantly, I think the future is kind of expanding into different verticals and kind of going more into the corporate integration route where we're kind of dealing directly with HR managers at companies of all different sizes to try to integrate this more into their HR platform and maybe have this be something that is offered as a benefit.
All right. There is a part of me, the sort of grumpy Gen X part of me, that looks at this and says, ugh, spoiled millennials want to travel around the world, work remotely, and have everything be perfect. Do you guys get that reaction?
From grumpy Gen Xers?
Yes.
You mean? Yes, of course, all the time. No, we get that reaction from grumpy everybody, right? And look, I understand where the sentiment is coming from. But I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there about millennials and what they want and what motivates them and what makes them tick, right? We live in a world now where it's not about, I mean, you used to hear even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you used to hear about work-life balance, right? What does that mean? I don't know what that is. I think a lot of people don't know what that is. We live in a connected world. I think it's work-life integration now, right? And so everything is connected, everything's integrated. And so you kind of have to look at that work-life integration and say, okay, my work and my life are going to be integrated regardless. So how can I make this something where I'm still working, I'm still progressing my career, but I'm not missing out on some of the great experiences of life. And I feel like I'm meeting new people and I'm growing personally and I'm understanding the world and all this stuff. So it's not about, hey, we just want to travel and party and have a good time. It's about what makes millennials tick. And it's not so much the financial stability. It's not 401k matching. It's they feel connected to the world and the world's calling and they feel like these global citizens. And there's some good, wholesome things behind this kind of push to travel and explore and be part of a bigger thing that isn't just a kind of a selfish one-off act.
Nathan Yates, founder and attorney for WeRoam, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Is this your bag, sir?
Yes, it is.
We'll have to hand check it.
Go ahead. I have nothing to hide in my bag.
Come with me, sir.
Whoa, wait here, pal.
That was Steve Martin as Inspector Clouseau in the updated Pink Panther movies, going through airport security. Yeah, Peter Sellers shouldn't have to do that part. Security checkpoints, bag drops, boarding, etc. It is a lot of waiting around for passengers, and it also demands a lot of staff. So what if you could breeze right through, and all you had to do was give the airline your fingerprints or check in with facial recognition? JetBlue and Delta are trying out biometrics in some U.S. airports, and British Airways is giving it a shot at London's Heathrow Airport. Would you do it? A recent survey from the air transport tech company CETA says 57% of passengers would prefer a biometric check-in process. And JetBlue says plenty of customers are opting for their facial recognition tools. We wanted to learn more about the implications of biometrics and travel, so we're turning to our own Molly Wood. Hey, Molly.
Hi, Lizzie.
So these biometric checkpoints, or I guess trial ones, pilot programs, no pun intended, what do they mean for airports, airlines, and kind of the way we move through the air travel system right now?
Well, I think that there are sort of two answers to that. There's what airlines and even maybe TSA hope they will mean, which is expedited boarding, quicker and more secure security checks themselves, and a streamlined and easier airport experience. More likely, in the short term, what it will mean is a lot of different kinds of systems, expensive technology implementations, probably a little more promise than actual delivery of this sort of security nirvana that they're all working towards.
From the tech side of things, what do you have to do if you are an airline trying to mesh your technology operations with the TSA and then potentially with, you know, other government agencies? How hard is that and how secure is it?
Yeah, technically speaking, it's very hard. It's going to be one thing for you to have expedited boarding at JetBlue, for example, using a fingerprint scan or a facial scan. This is all very easy to do at the individual gate level and private company by private company. Where things get really tricky and potentially significantly less secure is when you start trying to combine databases. Let's say you want one single database of everyone's face and everyone's fingerprint that you can call on. That database itself is a very scary situation because it's likely to be very hackable and it has a whole bunch of really valuable information all in one place. Are we talking about a future where people are making, exact replicas of your face and wearing it like a mask? Maybe not. But we also know that photos in some cases are good enough to fool facial recognition technology. So the privacy implications are significant, especially if you have a lot of companies and a lot of companies plus the government working together and storing images and information all in one place.
When I think about this, this is something I do on my phone with some things. I use my thumbprint. That's what a consumer sees. How complex is the back end of that?
Yeah, that's what a consumer sees. And, look, this technology isn't very hard. It's going to be very expensive. You are talking in the billions of dollars to implement this technology at scale throughout airports across the world. I think Delta has already spent about $600,000 to install just four machines that let you self-check in your own bag using fingerprint scanning. So that gives you an idea of the actual investment involved in putting all this technology into airports. So that is probably the biggest hurdle of them all. Technologically speaking, like you said, this is something we all do every day. A lot of people do on their phones. And it's, it existed in laptops a decade ago and didn't really take off. So in terms of of quick and accurate scanning of face and fingerprint. Not super hard, but again, once 50 to 100,000 fingerprints a day start touching that machine, there will be a noticeable uptick in Purell use, but also maybe a lot of breakdowns.
Who pays for all this?
This all is going to work better if everybody is trying to work toward the same goal. And so airlines are probably hoping that the TSA will help them pay for it, that security agencies will help pay. But again, that raises those risks of, will consumers be willing to buy into a system that shares sensitive biometric data with both companies and governments, and companies that are international? They don't know how things are going to be stored here or overseas. That part of it then starts to get a lot more complicated and political and not consumer friendly.
When you think about what going through the airport of the future might feel like in 10 years, what do you see?
I think in 10 years, it's very likely that it actually will work this way, despite all of those concerns. I think the investment and the build out will take a long time, but it is really likely that there will be some sort of facial recognition or iris scanning, probably not fingerprint, that will identify you and get you onto planes faster, and that a more rigorous identification process is just going to be part of how we live. It'll feel easier, but it'll be more intrusive.
Molly Wood, host and senior tech correspondent. As always, it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Lizzie. Thanks.
To get a better idea of how airlines' experiments with biometrics fit into the landscape of security, we called up John Pistol. He used to run the TSA, and he's now the president of Anderson University. He says that biometrics could grow to become part of the already high-tech screening system, but a lot of security is actually invisible.
People aren't seeing, you know, the data checks that are being done against the terrorist watch list, and is this person a no-fly or somebody that should be selected for secondary screening because of concerns in their database. And so that's part of it. But then there's also plainclothes behavior detection officers or police officers who may be in airport terminals. The bomb-sniffing canines are obviously seen. But there's so many layers in the unseen portions. Again, the intel on the front end, the intelligence on the front end, is one of those key enablers to be able to differentiate between higher risk, those who should be banned from flying, and those who are low risk, those who are in the trusted traveler program, such as Global Entry and TSA PreCheck.
And yeah, okay, maybe you see dogs or agents, but he disputes the idea that this is security theater.
There's mistakes that are made. There's human frailties, and systems don't work perfectly all the time. And that combination means that, yeah, mistakes are made from some time. But far from being security theater, it is the system in the U.S. is one of the most robust in the world. And again, it is serves as a deterrent to the bad guys.
For now, unless you're at a JetBlue or Delta hub, you probably won't see too much biometric screening. But as security adapts on both the front and back end, you can be pretty sure your travel is going to have a lot more tech in it. I can admit that I have probably lost days of work productivity since 2011 by watching brown bears in Katmai National Park in Alaska catch and eat salmon on a live video stream. It's known colloquially as Bear Cam, and 22 million people watched it in 2015. There are also osprey cams, eagle cams, walrus cams, puffin cam that is my producer's favorite, all from remote corners of the globe, and they are streamed by the nonprofit organization Explore.org. Charlie Annenberg Weingarten founded it, and he's also vice president of the Annenberg Foundation. And to be honest, I have wanted to do this interview for 3 years. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me here.
So take me back to the moment when you thought, hey, we can put some money into this thing and bring bears and ospreys and walrus and all sorts of other animals to people all over the world.
You know, it's interesting where inspiration comes from. I had always wanted to connect people to nature because I believe that the best form of philanthropy is when you fall in love with something and develop an emotional connection And the bears and the salmon is one of the most iconic visuals. And it was such an honor when the Park Services allowed us to work with them to help educate the public.
Well, so how did that work? Like, what were those conversations?
Well, there were a series of them. We literally were just on the phone with the National Park Service. And I think the connection between Explore.org and the Park Services was simple. Explore is completely philanthropic, and really one of our driving values is purity in educating the public in the purest form possible. So we don't try to manipulate nature, we don't try to sensationalize it, and the Park Services share that vision of trying to educate and enhance and enlighten the world about the work they do, and it's just been a beautiful relationship.
Well, so how do you do that? How do you maintain that purity and still get, you know, 22 million people looking at your cams?
You know, it truly is a fine balance. And I think in today's world, the currency of Explore and what makes it so unique is the purity that manifests itself. Everything so often is sensationalized today for ratings and everything. And, you know, I don't know what will happen with technology, but we'll be remembered as truly pure stewards of the natural world.
Can you make that go further? After all, you know, I can sit in an office in New York City and watch the bears, and it's a really moving experience, but that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, donating to animal conservation or that I am taking environmental action. It just means I'm passively participating.
And I think that's fine. Sometimes when I look at these cams myself, I think of them as an antidote to stress. The world's going through a lot of difficult times right now, and I feel like Explore.org is an oasis of peace. And so I think that's fine. Isn't that what nature's about? Isn't that what parks are about? To be able to explore and to let go. And so I truly believe that that's okay. I don't think that you have to
get
involved.
To give $5 or do anything like that?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why I say that.
Yeah.
I've traveled through every state in America. And what I discovered was there are so many amazing, hardworking people out there. And they want to get involved, but they don't have the means. And it makes them feel bad. And the fact that they can connect, because truly the most valuable currency in any movement is your time. And so what happens is when you're on Explore, you can connect with these nonprofits. And eventually they do give. They don't give out of a guilt-ridden state. And so anyone can give. It's just that we don't make that the emphasis because the first step is learning, awareness, education. And I think if you really do want to give, you will. But a lot of people don't have that fortunate background to be able to do that. Yeah. And you have to respect that.
You know, I'm talking to you because the bear cam, and I should say cams, as there are many, is what drew me to this. But there are all sorts of other cameras. Do you have a favorite?
You know, like I said, they're all like my kids, I feel like. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the bear cam is just, there's nothing like it. It's really, it's so neat to be able to allow people to voyeur like this and connect. I love them all. You're talking to the wrong guy. But yes, the bears are they have a special place in my heart.
Charlie Annenberg-Weingarten, thank you so much for talking with me.
It's a pleasure to be here. Have a great day.
Now we're going to go from looking at a national park at your desk to, well, being in one. Last year, the Appalachian Mountain Club, a nonprofit that maintains hiking areas throughout New England, earned over $12 million in revenue from its various campsites, visitor centers, and hiking lodges. And some of those lodges are on top of actual mountains. So the only way to get there is by trail. In other words, we can get to these beautiful places because of the work of trail crews.
I'm Eric Samia. I am the projects coordinator of the Appalachian Mountains Club North Country Volunteer for Trails program, and I work in the White Mountain National Forest. Well, I grew up in the White Mountains. My father was a backcountry ranger for many years, so that's why my family moved up here. What I've always thought of as being home is just being just out there in the backcountry. I've been doing trail work for the better part of like 6 or 7 years. I've been working for the Appalachian Mountain Club for the last 5. I love the hard work and how much your body hurts and how tired you are at the end of every single day. It's just a really good feeling. There's nothing more rewarding than trail work, from my experience. Here in the White Mountains, we do a lot of rock work. So, you know, a lot of people ask us, oh, how do you get the rocks here? Do you just have them like airlifted in? And that is not the case. We have to go and quarry the rocks. So we go out into the woods, dig out the rocks, get them out of their holes, and get them to the trail to where you want to build a structure. And then you got to dig a hole specifically for that rock and make sure it's set in the hole, not wiggling or anything. As well as felling trees. We fell trees, process them, turn them into bog bridges, steps, whatever we need to do. But we do a lot of, you know, rock work and timber work, a lot of drainage work. You know, if it's just a general maintenance day, then you could hike, multiple miles. It's the White Mountains, it's Maine, pretty steep terrain. Even just a mile and a half pack in could be a lot. I don't know how to really put it into words, really. There's just, like, nothing like it. It's the most rewarding experience of my life, from teaching outdoors to building trails. All together, it's just a magical, beautiful thing to be a part of. I don't think I really ever see it as a tourism thing. I see it as a more of a conservation-based mission. We go out and do a lot of work on these trails so people can go out and enjoy them. I think it'd be good if everyone maybe did a week of trail work at some point in their lives. It'd put a lot of things in perspective.
That was Eric Samia from the Appalachian Mountain Club. Coming up next week on Marketplace Weekend, a fight on the Mexican border that you don't hear about. Over water.
Sila Juarez began running out of water on the main aquifer it shares with El Paso, Texas. So they looked west. And when they looked west and saw that there was this relatively prolific, untapped source on their side of the border, they decided they wanted to go in and tap it. So it was like overnight, Juarez turned on a switch that turned on demand the size of the second largest city in New Mexico. Juarez started drinking up as much as Las Cruces does.
That's next time on Marketplace Weekend. And remember, you can get in touch with us anytime. We love to hear from you. Like these folks who reached out on a recent story we did about electric vehicles and range anxiety. Basically, you're running out of battery when you're out and about. On Facebook, Mike Keogh wrote, I have a 2017 Volt. No range anxiety. Love it. And Brittany Liu told us about her experience with her new Fiat 500e. 25-mile round-trip daily commute, and she says the savings are incredible. Email us about anything you hear on the show. We are weekend@marketplace.org. And we're on Twitter, @MarketplaceWKND. And you can get some inspiration for our weekend-long reads and a few recipe tips from me if you subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to marketplace.org. And that is our show for the week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Sean McHenry. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.